All right, let's jump right in. Imagine this. You're shackled to a post under the blistering Alabama sun for hours. No water, no break, just scorching heat. And the sound of guards laughing at you sounds like something out of, I don't know, a really brutal historical movie, right?
It does, but this actually happened in 1995 to an inmate named Larry Hope, in his case, Hope v. Pelser. Well, it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and it's a lot more relevant than some dusty old legal case, I think.
Yeah, definitely. This isn't just about like one man's suffering. It really gets at, what's considered acceptable when we talk about punishment. Like, when do we cross the line from, keeping order to just outright cruelty?
Exactly. Hope v. Pelser really forces us to confront the Eighth Amendment, that whole cruel and unusual punishment thing. But it goes even deeper. It brings up these questions about qualified immunity and how we hold officials accountable, even those working in the prison system.
Okay, so let's get into the specifics of Larry Hope's story. So he was subjected to this punishment. It's called hitching post. And not once, but twice.
And it's the difference between those two incidents that makes this case so interesting. The first time, this was in May of 95. He was restrained for like 2 hours, which is already pretty harsh. But he was given water breaks and bathroom breaks, which actually followed the Alabama Department of Corrections' own regulations.
So you could say that it seemed like on the surface, at least, they were, I don't know, like following the rules, however brutal those rules might be.
Right. But then just a month later, in June, things got much worse. Hope got into it with a guard, and this time the hitching post punishment, well, it was taken to another level.
Yeah, this is where it gets really hard to hear. 7 hours under the Alabama sun, shirtless, no water. And the guards, instead of showing any compassion, were taunting him about being thirsty. It's just, yeah, how do you even justify that?
Well, that's what the courts had to figure out. And here's the crazy thing. Alabama was the only live knee state in the entire country still using hitching posts as punishment at this time.
Really? Wow. I mean, even beyond the cruelty of it, it just seems so, I don't know, archaic.
It really was. And it's not like nobody said anything. The Department of Justice had already issued this report, a pretty critical one, condemning the practice, saying it was unconstitutional. So you've got the federal government saying this is wrong, but Alabama's still doing it.
So what happened next? Hope obviously wasn't good to just let this go.
Definitely not. He sued under Section 1983, claiming his Eighth Amendment rights were violated. That protection against cruel and unusual punishment. Section 1983 is important because it gives you a way to hold state officials accountable when they violate your federal rights.
Right, so this isn't just some, internal prison matter. It's about whether the state itself was acting unconstitutionally. But the lower courts, if I remember correctly, they sided with the guards. Why was that?
That's where qualified immunity comes in. It's basically this legal shield that protects government officials from lawsuits, even if, their actions violated someone's constitutional rights.
So they can do something wrong, something that violates the Constitution, and still be protected? That seems kind of messed up.
Well, there are limits to qualified immunity. It only applies if the official's actions didn't violate clearly established law. Basically, the lower court said, okay, yeah. What the guards did was awful, but there wasn't a specific rule that said they couldn't use the hitching post like that.
So they kind of got off on a technicality.
In a way, yes, but the story doesn't end there. The Supreme Court took the case, and let me tell you, they were not happy with the lower court's reasoning.
So the Supreme Court steps in. What was their take on this whole qualified immunity thing? It sounds like the lower courts set a pretty high bar for holding these guards accountable.
Yeah, they did. And the Supreme Court, well, they weren't having any of it. The majority opinion, it really took the lower courts to task, saying they'd missed the forest for the trees, basically. You see, it wasn't just about whether there was a specific case about hitching posts. It was about whether the guards had fair warning that what they were doing was wrong.
Ah, so that's where that fair warning idea comes in. How do you prove something like that? Especially when we're talking about something, well, as subjective as cruel and unusual punishment.
That's the big question, right? And the Supreme Court actually laid out a pretty clear roadmap in Hope v. Pelzer. They pointed to a few different things that should have tipped those guards off, that they were crossing a line. Remember that DOJ report, the one that was so critical? That explicitly called out hitching posts as a violation of the Eighth Amendment.
Right. Seems pretty hard to ignore a warning like that.
Exactly. And the court even cited a couple of previous cases from the Fifth Circuit, Gates v. Collier and Ort v. White. Now, these cases weren't about Hitchin posts specifically, no, but they did establish this broader principle that painful physical punishments were, well, a no-go in prisons.
So even though there wasn't a case with the exact same facts, there was enough precedent out there to make it clear that inflicting that kind of pain, especially without any penological purpose, was wrong. It wasn't like they were in, you know, uncharted legal territory or something.
Precisely. But here's where it gets even more interesting. The court also brought up the ADOC's own regulations. Remember, those regulations, technically, they allowed hitching posts, but only with breaks in water.
Oh, right. Those rules.
Yeah.
That the guards completely ignored in that second incident with Larry Hope.
Exactly. And the court basically said, look, even your own internal policies recognize that this punishment can easily become cruel and unusual if you don't follow the rules. That should have been like a giant red flag.
It's almost like those regulations, well, they backfired, you know, they were meant to provide guidelines, but they ended up as evidence against them. Kind of ironic, huh?
Definitely. And this part of the ruling, it's especially important for lawyers who handle cases involving constitutional rights. It shows that internal policies, they can be powerful tools, not just for holding individuals accountable, but for putting pressure on institutions to make sure their policies are actually constitutional.
So it's not enough for a prison or any government agency, really, to just have rules on the books. They have to make sure those rules actually line up with the Constitution, or else, well, they could be in for some serious legal trouble.
Absolutely. And this idea of fair warning, it goes beyond just, you know, written rules. The court was basically saying that officials need to be aware of the bigger picture, including court decisions and those DOJ reports. They can't just claim ignorance.
It sets a high standard, huh? For what's expected of people in power. They can't just blindly follow orders or stick to outdated practices. They have to know the law and act accordingly.
Exactly. But of course, there's always another side to the story. We can't talk about Hope v. Peltzer without mentioning Justice Thomas's dissent. He didn't really buy into this fair warning thing.
Oh, right. Justice Thomas. Always with the dissenting opinions. What was his take on this?
He argued that without a more specific precedent, one that, you know, dealt with basically the same facts, the guards couldn't have known their actions were unconstitutional. He thought the majority was setting the bar too high for qualified immunity.
So he was saying, unless there's a case that says, you know, don't shackle an inmate to a hitching post for 7 hours with no water under the hot sun, those guards should be off the hook.
Well, he didn't say it exactly like that. But yeah, that's the gist of his argument.
Yeah.
And to be fair to Justice Thomas, he does raise some interesting points about how we define clearly established law. Like, how specific does a precedent have to be? Do we need a case for every single situation? Or can we, you know, draw broader principles from the existing case law?
Yeah, I can see how that line can be tricky. You want to give officials some clarity, some protection, but you also don't want to create a system where they can get away with, you know, truly awful things just because there wasn't a case that perfectly mirrored the situation.
That's the tension at the heart of qualified immunity. And Hope v. Peltzer really highlights it. It's a debate that's still going on today. And it has huge implications for how we hold officials accountable.
Okay, so we've talked about how the Supreme Court, you know, set this new precedent with Hope v. Peltzer,
yes,
basically saying you can't hide behind qualified immunity if what you did was just, like, clearly wrong. But did the case actually change anything out in the real world? Did it actually make it easier to hold officials accountable?
Well, that's the big question, right? And the answer, like a lot of legal stuff, is complicated. Hoke v. Peltzer definitely had an impact. But it's more about, like, shifting the conversation than causing some huge, you know, overnight change.
So it's not like all of a sudden every guard and cop in the country started, like, studying the Eighth Amendment and DOJ reports, right?
Right. Not quite. But it did send a message, a strong one, and we can see its influence in a lot of cases that came after. It gave lawyers a kind of roadmap for how to overcome qualified immunity. It showed that you don't always need a precedent that matches perfectly to hold officials accountable.
Okay, so give me an example. How has Hope v. Peltzer been used in other cases?
Well, one case that comes to mind is Wilkins v. Gaddy. It went to the Supreme Court in 2010. And it involved a prisoner who was beaten really badly by a guard.
That sounds kind of similar to the violence in Hope v. Peltzer.
Yeah, it does. So you might think, okay, brutal beating, clearly excessive force, easy case, right? But the guard, he tried to use the qualified immunity defense, saying there wasn't a case with, like, identical facts that would have told him what he did was wrong.
So basically the same argument as the Hope v. Peltzer guards.
Exactly. But the Supreme Court, they shut that down. citing Hope v. Peltzer, they said it was obvious that the guard's actions were excessive, that he should have known it was unconstitutional. It didn't matter that there wasn't a case about that exact type of beating. The principle of obviousness, that idea that some things are just plain wrong, even without a specific rule, that came from Hope v. Peltzer.
So even though Wilkins involved a different kind of abuse, the main point from Hope v. Peltzer still applied.
Right. And we see the same principle in other cases about excessive force, both in prisons and out on the streets.
Interesting. So it's not just about prisoner rights then. It's about setting a standard for, like, how law enforcement interacts with people in general.
Exactly. Another important case that used Hope v. Peltzer was Kingsley v. Hendrickson, a 2015 Supreme Court case about use of force against someone in pretrial detention. The court, again, emphasized this idea of objective reasonableness.
What does that mean, objective reasonableness?
It means we shouldn't focus on whether the officer thought what they did was necessary, but whether a reasonable person would have done the same thing. Basically, it shifts the focus away from what the officer meant to do and looks more at the actual impact of their actions.
So even if an officer says, like, I really thought I was doing the right thing, they can still be held liable if what they did was unreasonable, even if they didn't mean to do anything wrong.
Exactly. It takes away that, you know, I was just following orders defense. And that shift in thinking, that focus on what actually happened because of the officer's actions, well, that comes from Hope v. Peltzer.
It's kind of amazing, isn't it, how a case about a guy shackled to a post in Alabama could end up changing how we think about, you know, police accountability and use of force. It really shows the power of legal precedent and how one case can lead to so much change.
It really does. But we shouldn't get too excited. The debate over qualified immunity isn't over. There are still a lot of people, including some powerful judges, who think Hope v. Peltzer went too far and that we need to make it harder to sue government officials.
Right, like Justice Thomas. With his dissent, he thought the court was making it too easy to sue officials.
Exactly. And we see that same argument in some newer cases, like Kissela v. Hughes, which we talked about before. That case made it a lot harder to overcome qualified immunity, especially in excessive force cases.
Seems like the courts keep going back and forth on this.
Yeah, they do. That's how the law works, I guess. It's always changing. And cases like Hope v. Peltzer, they're part of that change. They push the limits, challenge the status quo, make us think about these complicated questions about power and accountability and, you know, the limits of what the government can do.
So what are the main things to remember here? What do you want our listeners to walk away with? Especially those who work in, you know, criminal justice or civil rights.
I think the most important thing is that Hope v. Peltzer gave us this powerful tool to challenge official misconduct. It showed that even when the system seems designed to protect people in power, we can still hold them accountable.
Yeah. It reminds us that the law isn't, like, set in stone. It's always being shaped and reshaped by cases like this. And that even small legal wins can have a huge impact.
Yeah.
Beyond the people directly involved in the case.
Absolutely. And for lawyers, it's a call to action. We need to be aware of these precedents and understand how to use them and keep pushing the boundaries of holding officials accountable.
Well said. Hope v. Peltzer might be about a specific set of facts, but it's really about something bigger. It's about that constant fight to make sure justice wins out, even when it's hard.
I couldn't agree more. It's a reminder that we all have a part to play in holding those in power accountable and fighting for a more just world.
I think that's a great place to wrap up our deep dives into Hope v. Peltzer. It's been really interesting exploring all the twists and turns of this case, and I hope our listeners have learned something about how important it is and how it's still shaping the legal world today.
Thanks for having me. It's always great to, you know, dive into these complicated legal topics and see how they actually affect people's lives.
And to our listeners, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into Hope v. Peltzer. Until next time, keep learning, keep asking those tough questions, and keep fighting for a more just and fair society.